Welcome to the Alien Wellness Think Tank podcast series. The Think Tank is an emergency medicine organization led by residents for residents to improve the culture of wellness during residency training. Take a listen to our conversations with our wellness strategists and mentors. Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Lin, and I have the pleasure of setting up this episode in the Wellness Think Tank series featuring two accomplished emergency physicians from the Gold Coast in Australia who have interestingly implemented innovative on-shift mindfulness practices in the emergency department. They are my two new besties, Dr. Ashwini Amaratunga and Dr. Shahina Braganza. They interviewed my good friend, Dr. Scott Weingart, who spoke on this important topic of practicing mindfulness recently at a SMAC conference. It's not a woo-woo thing, but an integral part of boosting your mental capacity, and what's more important than training your brain in this knowledge economy age. Let's take a listen.
Hello, everyone. My name's Ash. I'm an emergency physician from the Sunshine Coast, and I've got with me Shahina, who is an emergency physician from the Gold Coast Health Service. And we are very honored to have with us today Dr. Scott Weingart from the infamous MCRIT podcast.
So, Scott, you have spoken extensively on various platforms about your thoughts on, be it mindfulness or meditative practice or some kind of reflective practice. Would you mind just giving us a summary of what your thoughts are on how this practice actually helps improve our performance and perhaps how it helps improve our wellness as well?
Sure. So there's many putative benefits to meditative practice, and some of them seem far-fetched, and some of them are absolutely proven currently by the literature out there in real scientific journals, not, you know, spiritual places where only people who have various gongs and statues in their houses would frequent the stores they're sold in. So this is real stuff. And what we could say pretty definitively is stress reduction. And what we could say pretty definitively is increased empathy to the people around you. And then there's the one that I have found most important in my life, which is it provides a small space in which you could choose the reactions you have to the stressors we are exposed to every day, both in the hospital and in our personal lives. All of a sudden, you get an option. You're not guided by other people's behavior into a pattern of reaction. You have the choice. You could kind of have a moment to ask yourself, do I want to react at all? And if so, what would the best reaction be? And that alone would make this a valuable practice. That alone could change your life dramatically.
You've mentioned in your podcast, Scott, that you were first introduced to it at the time when you were doing your martial arts as a teenager, and then kind of had a big gap and then went back to it. What was it that made you go back, and what changed your mind?
So the part that stuck with me from my experience in the martial arts, because I don't, in the course of my everyday life, I don't really need to beat anyone up, thankfully. You know, aside from an occasional patient on PCP. But the thing that stuck with me is at the end of each class, we would just have to sit there in the very strict Zazen style of meditative practice. And, you know, for, I have to imagine, it was only 5 or 8 minutes at the end of class, you'd be sitting there in Seiza. That's up on your knees. It's not very comfortable when you start. And at first, I found it to be just abysmal. I just wanted to get the hell out of class and go take a shower. But after a few months, it became one of the real highlights of the class for me. And it was pretty much the only part of my day where my mind wasn't racing, where I just had a moment to clear my mind of everything going on, the stressors, the worries, the anxieties. And I wasn't a particularly anxious person. I can only imagine how good that must feel to people who are really in the throes of constant illegitimate anxieties. So that was what stuck with me as the best thing that came out of that practice in the martial arts. Now, there was never really a gap where I completely stopped, but for a good number of years, I would say this was so occasional as to not even be worth talking about. I certainly would not say I ever had a meditative practice at all during those years. You know, every so often, I realize I really stressed and I just access that same technique of forcing mindfulness. And it wasn't really until, I think, maybe the end of college, beginning of medical school, where I really started saying, this is probably a good thing to do more regularly, and really just made a pretty regular practice of what had then merged into a slightly different form of meditative practice called Vipassana, or what would be just mindfulness meditation.
I'll jump in there and ask you a question about something you said, Scott. You said it was towards the end of college that you kind of tapped back into something that you'd established for yourself already. What was it that prompted you to explore that further? Was it someone else, or was it yourself? Was it an event?
It's funny, and I don't have a clear explanation for this, but it seems to be pretty common and yet not spoken about. But the end of college seems to be, for many people, a really stressful time. And I knew I'd been accepted to medical school my sophomore year of college. And I, just for folks who have a slightly different system than we have in the United States, you would go to 4 years of college. And then if you go to graduate school, it'd be another 4 years in the case of medical school. And then you do an internship and a residency. And so my second year of college, I had already known I was accepted to medical school, and I had another 2.5 years to pretty much stress-free just enjoy college for the learning. So there was no reason that at the end of the university time, when I already knew I had been accepted, you know, for years, that there should have been any stress. And yet it was probably one of the worst times in my life. I just could not figure out why. And I would just have this constant overriding melancholy. And it turns out now, looking back and from talking to other people, it just seems like you're finally changing your life. You're leaving the sheltered embrace of a schooling system, and you're going to something else. And that change could really provoke a lot of stress in people. But I could not relax. I couldn't be comfortable in my own skin. And luckily, I found that warm, comfortable blanket of mindfulness practice. And it really changed what that year was from the beginning to the end of it, that last year of college.
Sure. Thank you. You've explained sort of the trigger or the stimulus. But if I pin you down on when you say you found that comforting blanket, was it just there within you the whole time and you tapped into it? Or was there an external input that reminded you about it? Can you remember?
No, like I said, it was always there. It was intermittent. So I had known about this. I had known what it did to my brain. And, you know, I likened it at the smack talk to exercise. And for me, at least, it's always been like that. The same thing. Like, you know, at some point someone shows you, here's a good set of exercises, you know, maybe in your physical education class in elementary school, they ran you through calisthenics and they said, look, you know, if you wanted to be fit, just do some sit-ups and some push-ups and some pull-ups. And so you knew the basic gist of it. But how often did you really do that through high school? No one did. I mean, some people did if you were playing a team sport, of course, but you still had that within you. You had the basic idea of it, and you knew how it made you feel. And that, you know, initially is a lot of discomfort and a lot of soreness and a lot of pain. And then if you ever had a point in your life where you had done it for any regular period of time, you knew after a few weeks, it did great things for you. Your body worked better. You looked better. Well, it's the same thing for meditative practice. You know, having done it in the martial arts, I knew what it did to my brain. But just like so many people fade away from doing exercise, I had faded away from it for a while. But I still knew in my head it's a good thing to do. And when you really need it, when you gain 50 pounds and you can't fit into any of your clothes, you know what needs to be done. Well, it's the same thing when you're going through a rough spot in your life and you know what leads to succor, what leads to some degree of release of that, then you go back to it. You get in shape. And that's why I keep likening, for me, a meditative practice to exercise, because that's exactly what it is on so many levels.
So our next question to you is, it's in three parts. What makes up your practice these days? How often do you give time to it? And then finally, do you actually practice it while at work?
Okay, so those are really interesting questions, especially the last one, but let's take them in order. I don't consider it a successful week unless I've done 4 sessions of at least 10 minutes of strict, well, not strict, I mean, that's the dumb word, of my vision of Vipassana meditation. And that's just the baseline. If I could do more than that, better things result. But if I haven't done that, and I track it, you know, there's all these habit apps out there you can get for your iPhone that say, okay, you know, it's time to meditate today, and you hit the snooze. Well, then it tells you the next day, you know, you missed a session. And if you meet your goal, if you get 4 in a row, then it starts tracking and says, okay, well, you did a week where you met your goal. Why don't you do another week where you met your goal? And it's all tapping into cognitive psychology, and it works. So I recommend, if you want to start a practice like this, you do something like that. So that's the amount of time as the very bottom I would consider to be a successful week is at least 40 minutes a week. And it's probably not enough, but it gets the job done. It's probably barely suffices. I do it with a device called Muse, and it's actually a signal-weighted EEG device. This is consumer grade. This is not a medical device. But what it does is it just tracks your EEG patterns and tells you with neurofeedback whether you're in a meditative state or not, whether you're in a mindful state or not. And I don't know the perfect precision, but it really aligns well with my own self-perceptions of when I had a good sit and didn't. And this is, if there's one thing I could recommend to people who actually want this to work for them, it would be something like this, some form of neurofeedback. Because without it, a lot of people, especially at the beginning of their practice, will think they're sitting there with clear mind, and they're not. They're so far from being aware of the sub-vocalized talking going on in their brain that they think they have a clear head because they don't even have enough self-insight to realize what the chatter sounds like. And then do I do it during the shift? And, you know, this goes into, you know, I'd seen your questions ahead of time. You guys were kind enough not to surprise me. So I know some of what's going to be asking in the future. And so what I'm going to say now, I think really bears to the practice that you folks and the brilliant ideas you guys are instituting in the ED. And if nothing else during a shift, I am a firm believer in the idea of one cleansing breath. And just at moments of stress, find mindfulness just for one breath. You don't have time for all that much more. But if you could take one mindful breath, one breath where you genuinely just are concentrating on that breath, you have other thoughts occurring, you let them flow away, and then you still have to take an additional breath because you didn't get your one mindful breath. But the concept of one mindful breath, and I didn't create this, I'm blanking on who it was who introduced me to this, but that is my practice at work. When I feel myself kind of getting frazzled, when I feel myself losing it, when I feel myself wanting to yell at someone, you got to get one mindful breath. And it may take you 20, but you got to get one.
One good one. I just, before Ash's next question, I'll share with you that yesterday morning, every Thursday morning, we dedicate a simple 5 minutes to, at the moment, it's a mindfulness practice, but Ash and I have been talking about broadening it more to a concept of wellness. And certainly if we do nothing else with our mindfulness practice, we feel that we're at least making a statement that this is something that's important to us, that wellness is something that's important to us. But what we did yesterday, instead of a sit, which we've come to realize may not be that meaningful or effective for some people in the audience, is that we did two things. I showed them a quote from Viktor Frankl, which you referred to in your response to the first question, related to that space to choose. And we discussed briefly how, you know, in an emergency department setting, at any given time, there are lots of things that can trigger you to respond in a very reflexive, almost primal way. But if you just take that moment to appreciate that you have the choice, and then you make a choice that is more reasonable or positive than you otherwise would have made, that can kind of short circuit negativity and it can stop a downward spiral. And the second thing we did was we just took three big breaths, longer on the exhale. And I was reminded that just last week, Victoria Brazel inputted at that point that one of her close friends, I can't remember who it was, suggests that every time you have to enter your password into some software at work, that's your trigger to take one or two nice big breaths. And so what you said has resonated really strongly. Yeah. In fact, I think her password may be take two breaths.
Oh, and I see now I'm going to be able to log into Vic's account and really mess up her.
No, it's probably take two breaths, 2-3 by now.
From listening to your previous podcast, Scott, that's something that you discussed even in your earlier Mind of the Resuscitationist podcast about taking that big breath. And it's definitely something I've tried to do being a new sort of consultant or attending in your world, having lots of stressful situations, but those big breaths definitely do make a big difference in how you...
You know, and you're absolutely on the right track, Ash. We have mentioned that before. We mentioned it in a slightly different vein, but you've kind of discerned the secret evil that I've been plotting. Because what folks like myself, Mike Loria, have been preaching is a concept that we didn't create, but has been in the military for a while now, called tactical breathing, in which you take an inhale for 4 seconds, hold for 4, exhale over 4 seconds and then hold that for four before the next breath. And what the secret of that is that it's making you mindful of your breathing, which clears your mind of other things and forces you to break the spiral of stress and to take oxygen into your brain. And all of those things are promoting in a very secret but necessary way mindfulness of the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And in so many different ways, it's been very helpful. So sort of moving on, there was a part of the previous question that we didn't really touch on. Do you think there are some effective ways that we can use to change the minds of skeptics amongst our colleagues so that they are sort of more embracing of these concepts?
Yeah, well, you know, I always, when people are skeptical, I have to ask them, you know, specifically why, because each form of skepticism has its own antidotes. There are some people that are skeptical as to whether it does any good. And I don't even know what to do with that, because if nothing else, a definitive side effect of mindfulness practices, you get to know your own brain. That's all mindfulness is you just sit there with your brain or your mind or whatever vision of how things work is for you. And you just have to confront the reality of it. And so many people just walk through their lives with pure reflexive action. There is no self-reflection. And so if that's where the skepticism is coming from, you're not going to win on those folks in general. At least that's been my experience, because they're so far from where they need to be, because there probably is some deeply inset fears that keep them from wanting to be self-reflective, that keep them from wanting to ever have a practice that exposes them to themselves. And there's probably a good portion of the population walking around like that. And if somehow they were forced into a meditative practice, or even forced just to confront their own brains, very good things probably come of that, I think. I don't know. I've never done it, but it just seems like it would be a great thing. But you're never going to make that happen. So in general, a lot of the hostility comes from a real fear of what there is. Now, then there's the people that just paint this all with the brush of woo, you know, that this is all just hokum. And where a lot of the people who practice mindfulness, I should say, are not helping this. They decided they would publish the transcript of my talk at SMAC in one of the American emergency throwaway journals. So they just published it verbatim. And I'm like, fine, you know, whatever. I don't think it's as good as the lecture, but if you want to do that, knock yourself out. You know, they typed it out and they put it there. And then there was a response, a new article from someone who seems like a very nice person, and I'm sure has an excellent practice of mindfulness. And all of the things he wrote very well might be true for him. I mean, he just talked about all of the woo-laden stuff that turns off anyone with a scientific mind bent and, you know, huge magical insights and spirituality and all this stuff, which might be perfectly true. But anyone reading that article is just like, this is a load of, you know, Deepak Chopra crap. And, you know, so it sets it back. So, you know, if that's their vision, then that's why my way of talking about this to anyone, if I do talk to them about it, is always, look, do you lift weights? Do you run? Well, that's your body, but what about your brain? What exercise have you done for your brain? What's the last thing you did to make your brain better, aside from just cramming more stuff in there? And if you get them to that point, you say, look, it's scientifically proven. You change neural pathways. Parts of your brain that were small get bigger. Parts that were bigger get smaller. Generally, people that have that happen are much happier with their lives. It's exercise. Your biceps get bigger if you do pull-ups. Your brain gets bigger in areas that you want it to if you meditate. And generally, you can get them past that. Then the third form of skepticism, the skepticism expressed by my friend Peter Brindley, a frequent fixture of SMAC, is, yeah, no, it all sounds good, but I can never do that. That's just a little bit too much on the edge for me. And, you know, you got to just get them to do it, because they're already ready. You know, if they accept everything you've said, but they're just like, it's not for me, then you got to get them to try it. Now, the problem with meditation, problem with mindfulness practice, as you two, I'm sure, know, is that the first couple weeks, maybe the first month, doesn't feel so great. It actually feels kind of crappy. You know, you're just like begging the timer to go off. You're like, this is horrible. The other way people experience it, and you two know this as well, because I'm sure, well, you guys might be far more advanced on the path than I am, but I still struggle with this, is sometimes you just can't get your brain to concentrate the way you want. And if you don't realize that, that's totally okay. If you don't realize, you just accept it, you go with it. And in fact, you might change your mindfulness to what's actually keeping your brain from wanting to concentrate on your breath, then you can get very frustrated, especially for the type A personalities. They don't do well with the beginning of meditative practice. You really need a guide. It's why, again, I keep stressing these neurofeedback methods may be the way to go, because all of a sudden the type A guys, and they're usually guys, there are gals out there as well, but the type A guys, all of a sudden it's a game. They've gamified it. You're like, I want to get a high score. Okay, well, how do I do that? Well, when I think this way, it doesn't work. When I start thinking this way, it does. And their brains, because of their pathology, all of a sudden puts them further on the path and not further back.
Absolutely. And I think you've hit on a lot of good points there in terms of, I've definitely experienced that when you're stressed about something anyway, it's very difficult to make it stop. And I think the book Mindful Geek really does go into that a bit more and talks about the importance of acceptance. And I think that book has really helped me kind of come to terms with it being okay.
Yeah.
It's something that I've recommended.
Absolutely. There's so much good in there. And some of the other things in that book that are useful for people starting their practice and just can't get with it is classically when you sit, and it was worse in the Zazen style, and you're just sitting in a very uncomfortable fashion. The reason they make you sit that way is, one, I mean, the posture is good eventually when you develop a more meditative practice. It's a sustainable posture, even though it sucks when you first start. It's very painful. When you first start, you just can't get past the sensations in your body. Well, there's no reason you can't switch your mindfulness to that. And, oh God, my knees are aching. Okay, well, just become your knees. You know, just focus your full attention on the pain in your knees. And all of a sudden, that's mindfulness practice. And so I always found that a nice release valve when I have a lot of stress going on. It's just, okay, I'm not going to be able to concentrate on my breath. Where do I feel the stress in my body? Let's play with that for a while. And all of a sudden you get body awareness. All of a sudden you start realizing, oh, when I get stressed, I feel it, you know, on the left side of my back. And okay, well, let me just live there for a little while. Let's just concentrate fully on that area. And now let's see if I can release the tension without moving. You know, let's see if there's just a way that I could just concentrate on relaxing those muscles. All of a sudden you discover, like, you could do stuff with your body you didn't think you could do. You have some volitional control over spasm, over things that you shouldn't ordinarily think you would have control over.
It's interesting. That book is called Go Shine. Go ahead.
No, The Mindful Geek by Michael Taft. That's what you were going to say?
Yes. And I think it's gold.
Ash, I was going to ask you to please excuse me for stepping in and suggesting that we maybe just flip the next two questions because it's kind of along the line that Scott was traveling down. And before I do, I was going to share, just like being one of the least adept people at IT on the planet, I'm probably one of the least adept people at mindfulness. And really, most of my mindfulness practice is what I do at work, you know, in front of everyone if we lead a meditative sit or something like that. But I found that even with that scant practice, that has actually had significant benefit for me. And so I can only imagine that if you had a more diligent practice, how much greater the benefits would possibly be. So it's not just another strain of my imposter syndrome that I have.
No, I think I was just going to say, and I think it's a strong distinction to make. There's multiple forms of mindfulness, and the one I strive for is to really get into those EEG waves, whatever practice is generating those EEG waves. And I could really attest that that has remarkable benefits above just a attempt to be mindful. But that attempt to be mindful alone, even without any of the other stuff, has dramatic benefits. So I think any degree of practice is worthwhile. And I think if all people wanted to do is just go every couple of weeks or every month and sit there together for 30 minutes and try to be mindful, that alone, I'm sure, would have benefit.
Great. Thank you. That's good encouragement. Scott, you spoke about, you know, for those people who might be skeptical or just have had no exposure or reflection on this kind of practice, that you should kind of make them do it. Along those lines, do you actually talk openly about your practice with your work colleagues? Do you somehow promote it at your workplace? Is it contagious?
You know, it's funny because SMAC was really the first time I publicly discussed this at all with people who I was not close friends with. And that's not because there's any shame in it, but I also don't discuss with anyone except my close friends, my physical exercise practices. You know, I have plenty of friends who will tell me in just intricate detail how many times they lifted last week and what their weights were. And I just don't care. And my trepidation is always that people would feel the same way or perhaps even look more askance if I start discussing meditative practice. Now, you know, there've always been people, residents, co-attendings who just by happenstance, it came up that we both, you know, shared these practices. And then, of course, I talked to those people. But in general, I was not espousing it. Now, like I say, we do these things with veils on, like tactical breathing, like stress reduction techniques during resuscitations. Well, you know, that's just me coaching in a language that's easily assimilatable, these same mindfulness practices. But I never came out and talked about Vipassana meditative practices or anything along those lines. Now, with my close friends, we do. And I happen to be lucky enough to have a few friends who, by their own path of discovery, have been doing this for years and also didn't talk about it. And it was always a happy accident when the conversation led this way. And I realized they've had a meditative practice for 30 years as well. And then, you know, now I know, okay, well, here's brethren that I could talk about this openly with.
Great. And what about the others, the ones in the concentric circle outside that and maybe quite beyond that inner circle?
I am not a proselytizer in any way, shape, or form for this stuff. And maybe I should be, but I probably won't be. I would think that, you know, an intervention that really could help people is to actually train people on how to do this if they've expressed an interest. Because, you know, what you really want is a teacher to get this right, at least for the beginning. And it doesn't need to be someone constantly in real time, but you want a few lessons and then you want someone you could come to after a while and ask the questions that we all come up to. And I've been lucky enough, or I am lucky enough, to be one of those people that could learn anything from a book. And I probably, though, would benefit from finding a real teacher of meditative practice. I'm leery because you don't have credentials that demonstrate whether you actually know this. You know, they put some of the gurus through a functional MRI scanner and asked them to meditate, and there was nothing. There was none of the signs that these people had ever been capable of meditating. And they might be wonderful spiritual teachers nevertheless, but I kind of want the teacher I went to for meditative practice to be run through the functional MRI or put on the Muse headband and see what we get. Because there's a lot of people out there that realize this is an easy path to influencing people and getting money. So all that is in the service of saying is, if you could teach people some basic practice, which only would take about 15 minutes, and put them on a neurofeedback machine. And for this, you probably would want to get one of the medical devices, which aren't so expensive. They're like $300-$400. And just give people an opportunity to do it with feedback, you know, a couple of times, 5 minutes at a shot. All of a sudden, they'll be doing it right, potentially, when they go home and try it on their own. Otherwise, they might just be adrift in what they think is mindfulness practice at the level I'm talking about, and they're probably not actually getting the real benefits of mindfulness.
So, Scott, your summary, you basically talked about three aspects of the benefit of this: stress reduction, increased empathy, and creating or recognizing that space to choose. So I am interested, if you think that there is benefit to this at an individual level, do you think that if as a group we approach this, and not that we sit around holding hands, but that at least that there is encouragement or permission even for us to engage in this practice, whether as individuals or in small groups, that there might then be benefit for a group or a team, particularly in a setting like the emergency department?
I think there is. I think how it happens would be, you know, the devil being in the details and stuff like this. Because, you know, if people are forced to do it, then you have a risk of ostracizing and really burning your bridges. If people have the option, then you're really going to have a self-selected group. It's really getting the people you can change to actually want to spend time on this. That's hard. Some practices that are easily done and can really happen in a group is the one cleansing breath, and making that a regular thing done before major resuscitations could very well do a lot of good. And if everyone's doing that together, I think there just has to be some form of team bonding that occurs, even in a team that's otherwise disparate, you know, the ad hoc teams that are so common in medicine. If everyone takes one cleansing breath together, if you could get past the, oh, this is so stupid vibe, that could be very powerful. The other thing that's been super helpful that could be espoused as a practice in a group is wishing well the people you despise. And again, I really should have attribution for all this stuff because I didn't make any of it up. But just at the end of each day, I just like to think about all the people that truly piss me off and hope that they have a really good day the next day. Not in some passive aggressive, you know, those people could go fuck themselves manner, but in a genuine manner. And you have to really strive to get the empathic muscles. And I don't know if I'm there yet, but I really try hard to go through the day, think of everyone who, you know, there was conflict or strife and just say, wow, I hope something happens tomorrow that makes that person smile. And if you get there genuinely, you will find a dramatic increase in your happiness. And exposing people to that as an option during stressful circumstances, if you could do it in real time, you know, when someone's being a real dick to you, or, you know, even patients when they're entitled or really just not treating the medical system like it should be, if you could just wish them well, that's been an immensely powerful practice.
Thank you. I think you just changed the PG rating on this audio recording to an M.
Well, you must have listened to enough right. MCRIT to know that was going to happen.
And I will throw in one quick question. You've mentioned Muse. What are your favorite or recommended mindfulness-related resources?
Yeah, that's it for me. Because, I mean, I really, just because I love it so much, I don't get money from this company. I'll just, in 1 minute, just explain what this is in practice. The headband already mentioned, it has some EEG electrodes that are built in. You don't have to put any gel on your head, none of that. It's just like, it's like wearing a plastic headband. You stick it on, it's there. And then the app that goes on your iPhone, when you are generating these mindful EEG waves, you are listening, for at least the app I choose, you're listening to the sounds of a seashore. And when you're in a good place, the sea sounds recede almost entirely. And what you hear is just occasional lapping of waves. And if you could stay in that state for a period of time, you hear just an occasional chirp of the seabirds chirping. If you are, on the other hand, your mind is in conflict, if you're generating the EEG waves of real, not concentrating, not mindful thought, then you hear the wind pick up and it gets louder and louder as your mind gets more in these disorderly waves. And so that's the only app I need, because I'll just set that. It has its built-in timer. I'll set that for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, depending on the day. And then you just strive to silence the waves. And then if you start hearing birds chirp, your brain gets that subconscious neurofeedback that you're doing a good job, and it burns in those pathways. Now, if you're not willing to invest in that, because I think it's like $200 to get the Muse headband, Headspace is a very good app for guided meditation. They will actually, you know, walk you through, like if you choose a 10-minute one, they'll tell you what to do, you know, concentrate on your breath, feel your stress, fade out, you know, concentrate on, depending on the meditation, you know, concentrate on your toes, feel the stress disappear there. I've never been one for guided meditation. It's never done it for me. In fact, I find the voice distracting, but some people swear by it, and some people will always, you know, for a 30-year practice, they'll go with a guided meditation. It just depends on what works for your brain.
Just going to say that I think I agree. The Headspace app is what I've been using, and it just keeps you on track, I think, to begin with. And then maybe later, occasionally I'll do it without, but it's been nice to have that as a guidance to begin with.
Yeah, for beginners, at the very least, I think they should try it before anything else, because it really gives you, it's like a helping hand. It's like a coach standing there telling you what you should be doing. And as you start to flag, that voice has some degree of reassurance that you're still on the right track.
Agreed. And he's got some nice, just little animations that are quite helpful and just reminding you that it's okay to let your mind wander.
Have to imagine that even people who have been doing this as their job, you know, like monks and such, for decades still have wandering minds. So you certainly shouldn't at the beginning feel any trepidation that you're getting it wrong. That's just the nature of the beast.
Absolutely. I think Michael Taft puts it well when he says you're just making the unconscious conscious, and that's all you're trying to do. So I think he kind of encompasses that nicely.
Absolutely.
Did you have any final comments for us, Scott or Shahina?
I would just say I think what you two are doing is valuable, and I'm so glad that people out there are making stuff like you are happen.
Thank you very much.
If Scott is comfortable, and Scott, please do your own thing. I wrote this very late at night. I got a bit carried away at the end, but please go for it.
Okay. Hi, I'm Scott Weinger from the MCRIT podcast. I'm passionate about resuscitation and critical care, And one of the things that makes me good at that job is my practice of mindfulness meditation. The benefits for my personal life have been reduction of stress, increased empathy for my fellow man, a set of feelings that I have not had built in at baseline. So certainly this has helped me progress along that path. And then what's most important to me, the ability to separate the stimuli in my life from my reflex reaction, the ability to actually stop and say, no, I don't have to get angry. There's no reason to, and I'm not going to do it. Now, my wife would disagree on how much the mindfulness meditation has actually helped, but most of the people in my life can say pretty clearly when I've fallen off the wagon and haven't meditated for a while versus when I can. I'm a better person. I do better interacting with other people. I used to think that there really was no reason to exercise our brains. And then through a number of encounters throughout my life, I realized just like you have to exercise your body or you get fat and you can't do the things you want to do, you got to exercise your brain. And meditation, mindfulness, it's one really good way of doing it. It's the best way I've found. So I know if you try it, and you can't just try it for a day, you have to try it for a few weeks, you'll feel something. And I think you'll like what you feel. So you should try it. It'll make your life better in the hospital. It'll make your life better with your coworkers, and it'll make your life better at home. It doesn't cost anything. So what's the harm? Give it a shot.
Thanks, Scott. That's awesome.
No, just thank you so much, Scott. You don't know how much this means to us. It's really, really awesome. Thank you.
Fun. No worries.
So, Scott, I guess in this project that started about 6 months ago, we've kind of come to the realization, there's ongoing realizations, but one of the recent ones is that, you know, for us as an ED team, mindfulness is not the destination. The practice is not the destination. The practice is actually the journey to get us to who we want to be and what we want to be. And for us, that has come about because we've set an intention and we were hoping that providence would come in some shape or form. And you have been a big part of that for me and for our department, basically. So at Smack Dub last year, Ashwini's husband, his name is Suneth Jayasingh, and he's a fellow emergency physician as well. But he came back and he said to me, you know, my parents have been practicing Vipassana meditation for the 30 years of my life, but I've never paid it any attention or any credence until Scott Weingart said that this is a good thing to do. And so I think you can rest assured that you've influenced a lot of people in that positive direction towards at least trying out this practice, if not adopting it. So we feel passionately.
I think he came up to me at the SMAC conference and he seemed like a super nice guy. So I'm so happy for that.
He is a convert, isn't he, Ash? He's an absolute convert.
He's a massive convert, thanks to Scott.
Since kettlebells for the brain. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So again, Scott, we can't say this enough, but we are hugely appreciative. And I hope you realize how much you've done, not just for us, but for our department by giving us of your time.
Wow, what a great discussion. And that's a wrap on this podcast featuring Drs. Amaratunga, Braganza, and Weingart. Bottom line, practicing mindfulness, it's legit. In this age where we are constantly in a state of continuous partial attention, don't we owe it to ourselves to spend some dedicated time just for ourselves to slow down, reflect, reset, and be mindful of who we are? Thanks for listening. And that wraps up a great episode from the Wellness Think Tank. Special thanks to our exclusive sponsors, US Acute Care Solutions. You can reach us also on Twitter at WellnessTT. Until next time, remember that residency training should be about thriving and not just surviving.